A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
An Erio's original.
I was born with a special gift. The ability to mentally transform any situation into the worst case scenario in my own brain. My therapist calls my gift catastrophizing. And that's why I'm uniquely qualified to scrutinize and analyze history's greatest disasters and find out who's to blame. They say history repeats itself. Not on my watch. My name is Rebecca Delgado Smith, and I am the Alarmist.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning into The Alarmist, a comedy podcast where we talk about history's greatest tragedies and figure out who's to blame. Today we'll be discussing the Tulsa Massacre. It's one of those that is not taught in history classes. I actually hadn't even heard of it until the Watchmen episode came out. I think it's important that we all educate ourselves and learn about these historical topics that have been buried in our nation's history. Let's get started. Here's what you need to know. The second largest city in its state, Tulsa, Oklahoma, was incorporated in 1898. After discovering oil in 1901, the town leaders promoted Tulsa as the oil capital of the world. Afterwards, Tulsa experienced an oil boom and its population skyrocketed. By 1920, it had over 70,000 residents and approximately 15,000 were black. Many of them lived in the community of Greenwood. Dubbed Black Wall Street, Greenwood was a thriving cultural and financial center with commercial businesses booming. Its affluent residents consisted of lawyers, doctors, entrepreneurs, and domestic workers for middle and upper class white families on the white side of town. These workers invested back into the Greenwood community and spent the majority of their paychecks at the local businesses, helping the area thrive. By 1920, Greenwood had 108 black-owned businesses, two theaters, a luxury hotel, a hospital, a library, two newspapers, and more than 20 churches. But the black community's prosperity caused resentment among many of the city's white residents. The threat of violence was very real for Greenwood, especially as white prejudice worsened, not just in Tulsa, but in the entire country. After World War I, unemployment rates were rising. Jim Crow laws were in place in the South as well as in states in the West, and the rebirth of the KKK fueled the racial tension in the country. Lynchings of African Americans were on the rise, with over 40 recorded lynchings just in Oklahoma since it had become a state 2 decades ago. It is against this backdrop that the Tulsa Massacre would occur. On Monday, May 30th of 1921, the city's Memorial Day festivities were in full swing. 17-year-old Sarah Page, a white female elevator operator, was working in the Drexel building in downtown Tulsa. Around 4 p.m., a 19-year-old black shoe shiner named Dick Rowland stepped into the elevator to go up to the segregated black bathroom on the top floor of the building. The play-by-play of what happened next inside the elevator is unknown, but moments later, Page screamed and Rowland ran away. A nearby white store clerk called the police. Page initially told police that Rowland had tried to assault her. The next day, Rowland was taken into custody. Rowland told investigators he had tripped while entering the elevator, fell against Page, and accidentally stepped on her foot. Later that same day, Page corroborated that account. The Tulsa Tribune, a white-owned newspaper, ran a story about the alleged assault with the headline, "Nab Negro for Attacking Girl in an Elevator." It quoted Page as describing the encounter as such. A few minutes later, he entered the elevator, she claimed, and attacked her, scratching her hands and face and tearing her clothes. The Tulsa Race Riot report mentions several people who additionally recall an editorial that ran in the same paper with the headline, "To Lynch Negro Tonight." But copies of the op-ed have not survived. It is believed someone destroyed all of them. By late in the afternoon of that Tuesday, a crowd of white Tulsans had gathered outside the courthouse where Rowland was being held. Meanwhile, a group of 60 armed black men, mostly veterans, having heard what was happening, had organized and went to the courthouse. They offered to help protect Rowland. The sheriff, Willard M. McCullough, knew the situation was getting heated, but deferred their offer. The previous year, Roy Belton, an 18-year-old white man arrested for hijacking and shooting another white man, had been taken from the Tulsa jail by a group of armed men and lynched. The incident led to fear in the black community about the ineptitude of the Tulsa policing and its jail system. In order to protect Rowland from suffering the same fate as Roy Belton, McCullough put armed guards on top of the courthouse, disabled the elevators, and surrounded him with officers. Outside, a group of white men demanded McCullough hand Rowland over. McCullough refused. By this point, there were over 1,000 white people congregated at the courthouse, many of them armed and shooting racially charged language. McCullough turned them all away. While they were leaving, a white man tried to disarm a black veteran. A shot was fired. Then, more shots. What transpired left 12 people dead in front of the courthouse. Two were black, 10 were white. By early the next morning, a white mob numbering more than 10,000 made their way to the Greenwood neighborhood with machine guns and cans of kerosene. While some Greenwood residents tried to fight back, they were quickly outnumbered by the white mob. Planes were flown to spy on the movements of the black community, and according to some, they were also used to bomb areas of Greenwood. White men, after looting the homes of black residents, set them on fire. Later, horror stories would emerge, like that of an elderly black couple who were saying their evening prayers when a mob broke in and shot both of them in the backs of their head. Then, after ransacking their belongings, set their home on fire. The burning, looting, and killing of the black community went on for 2 days. By the end of the massacre, the white mob had razed 36 square blocks, burned more than 3,000 homes to the ground, and killed as many as 300 people. Many of the dead were buried in mass graves or dumped into the Arkansas River. In addition to the 300 people killed during the massacre, up to 10,000 Greenwood residents were made homeless and left penniless. The neighborhood of Greenwood had been destroyed. Fun facts, aka death stats. Thousands of black Greenwood residents spent the winter of 1921 living in tents. It is estimated that in terms of today's dollars, the property loss in Greenwood exceeded $30 million. When the massacre ended on June 1st, the official death toll was recorded as 10 whites and 26 African Americans. Historians agree that the actual death toll is probably over 300, and most of those casualties were black. The hospital which treated black patients in Greenwood was burned, and many injured blacks had to be treated at the detention centers which had been established. The remaining hospitals in Tulsa were segregated and did not treat injured blacks because of their segregation policies. Rumors that Sarah Page and Dick Rowland knew each other and were in fact lovers began swirling shortly after the ensuing chaos, but there is no evidence of that beyond salacious gossip. Most historians agree that the account Roland gave to police of him tripping and accidentally stepping on her foot, the same account which was later corroborated by Paige, was most likely what happened. After the riots, the Ku Klux Klan saw an opportunity in Tulsa and started an active chapter. Photos of the massacre showing the city burning and dead bodies on the street were used as postcards by white supremacists and KKK members to brag about what had happened. Sarah Page declined to press charges, and prosecutors eventually dropped the case. So with us today, we have producer Amanda Lund.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, and filling in for Chris Smith is fact checker Clayton Early.
Hello, Rebecca. Hello, Amanda.
And our very special guest today is Randy Thompson. Hi, Randy.
Hi, everybody.
So Randy is a friend of ours from NYU, as well as the co-founder of the downtown LA comedy theater, The Ruby.
Ruby LA is a theater that a few of us started that was essentially founded around the values of intersectional feminism. We promote marginalized voices in comedy and do improv classes, acting classes, you know, and have shows and all sorts of things.
And listeners can check out The Ruby by going to
therubyla.com.
That's nice. You guys got the .com. We had to do erios.net. It's so embarrassing.
Oh, no. Who's the other Erios?
Honestly, I don't know. I just think we couldn't afford the .com.
Some dude who's just sitting on the domain name waiting for his money to roll in.
Yeah, well, joke's on him.
So I think we should dive right in. You know, where do we start? Probably the most obvious culprit of the massacre. We can start off by just putting racism on the board.
Just white people.
Right.
I literally have down
white people.
White bitterness.
Right.
Good.
Of course, like, you can go to college and get a PhD in order to understand the full context of just the state of racism in the U.S. before and during the massacre. But let's, you know, go through a few things just to kind of set the scope for our listeners. So 1863, we have the Emancipation Proclamation and slavery in the U.S. Of course, many slaves in the South were not freed until years later. It takes a while to get the word out. 1898, we have the recession of the late 19th century. It hits, and U.S. night riders went out in the dark, burning homes of African Americans who bought their own land. They rode up to Washington to demand change as Southern white Democrats rolled back many of the, albeit limited, freedoms from Reconstruction just a couple of decades before. So taking steps backwards already. 1915, the film Birth of a Nation. I'm going to say, let's put Birth of a Nation up just while we're at it. Up on the board. Okay.
Fair.
So Birth of a Nation comes out 1915. According to History.com, the film depicts the KKK as valiant saviors of a post-war South ravaged by Northern carpetbaggers and immoral freed blacks. It's important we talk about it because one of the many terrible things that the film depicts is the idea that black men are unable to contain their sexual urges toward white women, and that no white woman could be safe near any black man. And it actually stirs up the revival of the KKK. Now, something that I found interesting was that before 1915, before the film comes out, the Klan had never burned crosses.
Yes.
This is something that's in the film. And it was actually something that the director, D.W. Griffith, just thought it was like visually like cool. And then the KKK actually takes that on. So he actually gave them this grand idea. We have Birth of a Nation up on the board. I mean, D.W. Griffith, I guess the Birth of the Nation kind of encompasses the director.
Yeah, I feel like you could put him in as a parenthetical.
I don't think that we've ever like put so many things up on the board so quickly.
Yeah, so far we have racism, white people, Birth of a Nation. It's kind of like racism is the umbrella, and we're just putting all the little bullet points underneath it.
Yeah. It seems like white people is the umbrella, and it's just what kind of white offense is responsible.
White people.
Is it their white racism?
White people is always the umbrella.
1919, we have the Red Summer. Several things happened in the U.S. during this time. African Americans helped fight for the U.S. during the World War I. in huge numbers. And when they come back, they're walking down the streets of southern towns that they had just left a year or two earlier, and they're being spit on. So things are actually much worse once they come back. Another factor was the success of black sharecroppers. So according to The Nation, African-American cotton growers were actually making money in 1919 because there was a huge worldwide demand for cotton for textiles. Everyone needed clothing after the war, and they were buying houses, cars, land. Small southern white towns suddenly felt threatened. So the white Tulsan residents were actually starting to become resentful of not just the fact that they were making money, but in particular, they were living in this really nice area of town that they themselves had built, spending their own paychecks.
Yeah. Well, and I think the Greenwood section was built intentionally as a black area that the developer had bought up plots of land that basically would only sell to black residents at the time. So it wasn't even just like they were segregated in this into this part of town and then made it nice. It was that it was from its design designed to be a black section of town that was then, you know, successful.
They're saying post-Civil War that Oklahoma began to be promoted as a safe haven for African Americans. And that a gentleman named O.W. Gurley, a wealthy black landowner, purchased 40 acres of land in Tulsa, naming it Greenwood after the town in Mississippi. And he started with a boarding house for African Americans. And as word spread, more and more people flocked to the community. And it was basically, quote, for black people, by black people.
So I know that Greenwood was affluent, but were the surrounding areas really poor, or were the white neighborhoods nice too, and they were just angry that the black neighborhood was just as nice? Or was it mostly the poor whites who were kind of leading this?
There were some very wealthy white people in Tulsa. They had who had struck oil, and that was a big incentive for the black community to move there because many of them were domestic workers, and that was the kind of work that they could find. What happens, though, is that there's a depression that hits in 1920 to 1921. World War I has just ended, and this is according to FEE.org, officials found themselves in a bleak position. U.S. officials. The federal debt had exploded because of wartime expenditures, and annual consumer price inflation rates had jumped well above 20% by the end of the war. To restore fiscal and price sanity, the authorities implemented what today strikes us as incredibly merciless policies. From 1919 to 1920, federal spending was slashed from $18.5 billion to $6.4 billion, a 65% reduction in 1 year. The unemployment rate peaked at 11.7% in 1921. Which, by the way, what is our unemployment rate right now?
Well, how many of us are unemployed and we can run the
just
numbers?
A small sample size.
So I to answer your question, Amanda, I think that while there were a lot of rich white, you know, people living there, there was also like a very large poor white community. What do you think? I feel like we should put unemployment rates up on the board.
I mean, I think for a lot of reasons, it feels like a lot of people are ready. Like there were just like a lot of canisters of gasoline left laying around that are ready to like explode. And it just, I feel like we're seeing a ton of that right now in different ways. And I'm not at all saying that that's, you know, the singular cause there of unrest, but it definitely feels like that was a big contributor that, you know, the country has been for 2 months plus locked down just on Facebook, getting madder, and, you know, everybody's out of work. Everybody's mad about it. And it certainly, I feel like, was a big contributor to like things exploding as quickly as they did.
Right.
If not, you know, it's not the reason,
yes,
but not the cause.
So I have a suggestion, maybe kind of going more specific than white people might be white entitlement.
Okay.
Like just this feeling that they are the rage they were feeling that black people had as much as they had.
I think, too, there was, you know, in a lot of areas in the South, there were large classes of white people who were working, you know, alongside of the slaves who were maybe considered around the same social class, maybe not as slaves during slavery, but that when after they were freed, there was a kind of top down effort to instill this idea to those people that you are better than them, and create kind of resentment among the poorer classes to say, you know, yeah, maybe you don't have everything you want, but you deserve more than this person does, and creating, like, enshrining that resentment so that there isn't a larger class of people who are looking around and saying, the system isn't fair. We need to do something about this. You know, the landowners, the wealthy, the people who were in charge of government at the time had a vested interest in making sure that any poor white person believed in their heart that a poor black person is, as a default, less than them, that they are, you know, creating that separation right there.
So do we think that's entitlement, or is it resentment, or is it both?
I mean, I think entitlement is good because I think it covers both the people kind of at the top, the wealthier class in this country of whites who were interested in maintaining their own status, and also the poorer class who were then kind of, whether or not they believed this or they were manipulated into believing it, then felt like, you know, I'm better than you are.
I feel
so
like
I like entitlement.
Yeah.
Piggybacking off of that, I just want to throw in there, which is something I throw on in there every time I'm on your show, is
I know what you're going to say.
Money.
Oh, no.
Money.
What did you think he was going to say?
I thought he was going to talk about the thin line between status quo and chaos, utter chaos.
Well, that never goes away. That's always going to be
present. And honestly, that's also part of this. That's also like, oh, okay, we're all fine. Okay, thin line broken. Okay, it's chaos.
Yeah.
But what I mean is, in terms of what Randy was just saying, it's all about, like, who has economic opportunity, who has money, how do you keep people... You know, if you're the government on top running things, how do you keep people thinking they are worthy or not worthy? Like, money corrupts so many things. And if you could make it not about money, but about race and scapegoating and discrimination, then it's all like, let them infight while we make all the money over here.
For sure.
Okay, so what's that called? Like,
it's like race is a code word for money.
Capitalism?
Capitalism is what I've said in the past. That's the word.
Okay. I mean, we'll put it on the board.
It's not the blame, but
I mean, I don't know. I feel like there's definitely arguments for capitalism playing a huge role.
Exacerbating.
I mean, we're not there yet, but there's like a whole other theory about land speculation leading towards Greenwood's destruction.
Oh, okay, yes. Clayton, okay. Apologies. You might be onto something.
Thank you for that apology, Amanda.
We can talk about that real quick, because I don't think we say that in the Here's What You Need to Know section, which is after the massacre and after this whole section of town is burned to the ground. The white people in the in the city, they start trying to buy this land from the black landowners, and it was like, you know, they wanted to pay pennies on the dollar, you know.
Yeah.
And it was, and I think you're right in that, Randy, where it really feels like they were trying to acquire this part of the city, not just because they resented the fact that it was doing well, but also because as the city was growing out, it turned out that Greenwood was kind of, it was a nice location, and they did everything they could in order to take this land away from the residents. And it was only because of these black lawyers who fought and helped these property owners retain their property that they were able to maintain it.
Oh boy, would I like to see a movie about that. Sort of like an Aaron Brockovich.
Yes,
the Tulsa version.
Oh my God, that's a good idea, Amanda. We should write it. we'll start
I don't
today.
Think we should write it. Someone else.
More truth has never been spoken.
So good.
So let's talk about the Tulsa police. The New York Times said that the massacre that occurred was, quote, enabled by the Tulsa police chief by the name of John Gustafson, who deputized hundreds of white men on the spot. So after the initial gunfire at the courthouse, all hell broke loose, according to the Oklahoma Commission report. And this is what it says, quote, at police headquarters on 2nd Street, nearly 500 white men and boys, many of whom only minutes earlier had been members of the lynch mob, were sworn in as special deputies. According to Laurel G. Buck, a white bricklayer who was sworn in, the police instructed the new recruits to get a gun and get a Negro. Shortly afterwards, the whites began breaking into downtown pawn shops and hardware stores, stealing guns and ammunition. Eyewitnesses later testified that uniformed Tulsa policemen took part in some of the break-ins, handing out guns to whites. And there were even reports that the police took part in aerial attacks on the neighborhood. According to the Chicago Defender, who ran a story on October of 1921, months after, it said that, quote, a former Tulsa policeman identified as Van B. Hurley, who was white, had signed a 31-page affidavit in which he claimed city officials and law enforcement officers planned and carried out an aerial attack on Greenwood. Hurley asserted that the airplanes darted from hangars and hovered over the district, dropping nitroglycerin on buildings and setting them on fire.
I'm just going to throw in a quick fact that all of these things that you're talking about, none of these criminal acts, this is according to TulsaHistory.org, none of these criminal acts was then or ever has been prosecuted or punished by government at any level, municipal, county, state, or federal. And even after the restoration of order, it was official policy to release a black detainee only upon the application of a white person, and then only if that white person agreed to accept responsibility for that detainee's subsequent behavior.
Mm-hmm. So McAuliffe, the sheriff, his behavior is a little bit odd, right? Because first he will not release Roland over to the white mob, but then the black veterans that come in, he sort of calls them in, but then refuses to let them protect Roland. But is the idea that he's sort of purposefully inciting chaos amongst these two groups?
Well, that's the speculation. So McAuliffe, the backstory on McAuliffe is that he's new to the job. The last guy that was the sheriff lost the job because of the white man who got lynched the year before, right? Hmm. McAuliffe is the new guy. He's new to the position, and he's scared of losing it if something happens to Roland.
So it's almost like self-interest motivated. He's just trying to protect his job versus caring about the well-being.
I think once everything kind of blew up, then a lot of members of the police force, if not the whole police force, and then members of the National Guard as well, you know, after they had deputized all these men and kind of created a militia, that's when everybody joined in. I think prior to that, I think you're right. I think he had contacted local black leaders who then were turned away when they got there. They were, you know, they arrived to help. And then I remember reading that he had basically initially trying to prevent something like this from happening. And when the veterans showed up who were all armed to protect Roland, I think the inciting event, correct me if I'm wrong, was that someone tried to disarm one of those veterans, a member of the white crowd. There was like something like 1,000 white people who had gathered, and like 60 of these veterans who were armed. Someone had tried to disarm one of them, and then there was a struggle, and then shots fired into the crowd. And then from then on, it was just kind of off and running.
And all it took was that spark. It's really like we're trying to identify what was the spark that made all this tension come to a head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
So we should put McAuliffe up there. Of course, we should put the chief of police, John Gustafson. He's the only one who, you know, who actually goes, you know, up against a grand jury. And he is indicted on 5 counts. Well, I shouldn't say he's the only one who goes up against the grand jury. Many black men went up against the grand jury. Of course, most of the charges are dropped. Essentially, all I'm saying is he's removed from office and no criminal charges are brought against him. And he just resumes his occupation as a private detective.
Great cool. for him. I smell a big slap. So we only have we're winding down on putting people up on the board. So let's get the last few up. And
oh my God,
Randy,
we have so many.
Clayton, if you have any more to throw up, now's the time.
Do we put Sarah Page on the board?
I do think that we should put Sarah Page on the board. Not a lot is known about Sarah Page. All they say is that she's a 17-year-old orphan. Who was new. She was from Kansas City or something, and she was new to town and was paying for herself to go to school. You know, there's a lot of speculation, like whether they knew each other, whether she and Roland knew each other, whether it was they had like some kind of love affair. But that's all just like very salacious gossip, you know?
Yeah.
What is mostly agreed upon is that he tripped and stepped on her.
And I think it was something like the same day that she basically recanted and said, corroborated Dick Rowland's story, right?
Yeah. I feel like that kind of rolls into another culprit, which is all the gossip that started around the incident.
Yeah.
Even like during the fighting, there was like, I'm reading there's lots of like gossip about more people are coming with more weapons on both sides that like...
Yeah.
You know, escalated, and also what the media, like what the newspapers were saying about what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we should put the Tulsa Tribune up on the board.
For sure.
Randy has thoughts on the Tulsa Tribune.
Tell us.
Well, look, I don't want to be Trump about this. But there was the story that basically Tanaba Negro was the story that basically set everything alight. And then there's also reports in that what I was reading that there's no one can find any evidence of this story other than people's eyewitness accounts, that there was another story that was basically like, we are going to go lynch this guy tonight. Everybody meet at this point. Here's the address. Like it was basically an effort on the part of the paper to stir up this exact situation. And so I absolutely think that had an impact for sure.
For sure. Put them up on the board.
Fuck those guys.
Yeah. I think to me, you know, actions speak louder than words in the sense that afterwards they totally made sure that no copies survived.
What?
There are no copies of these stories. I think there's a copy of one of the stories, but there were
plenty. The first one,
yes,
reporting on the original, the Roland Page incident, yeah.
But there were op-eds that followed that were totally destroyed.
Yes. Wow.
So if that's not sketch, I don't know what is.
Mm-hmm.
Amanda, do we have the National Guard up on the board?
I'll put them up.
They were then called in after the police, you know, obviously couldn't, quote unquote, they were just helping, right? And they call in the National Guard saying this is out of control. And the National Guard then shows up. And of course, what they do is they just stand in front of white people's properties, businesses, and houses, and just wait for the retaliation they thought was coming that never came.
This is going to be a hard process of elimination.
All of the above.
But I know one that might get them all.
Oh, God.
Let's take a moment to speak with our guest expert, Tim Madigan, author of The Burning, Massacre, Destruction, and the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921, and hear what he has to say about the Tulsa Massacre. So, can you walk us through the events of Monday the 30th?
Dick Rowland was a young shoeshine boy who worked in White Tulsa. It was clearly he was familiar with and perhaps even had a romantic relationship with a white young woman, a white woman who ran an elevator in one of the downtown high-rises. One day, Dick Rowland gets on the elevator with him, and it's unclear exactly what happened, whether he tripped and fell into her or something else happened. Next thing you know, she's screaming assault, and Dick Rowland disappears, please, because it was a very bad thing for a young black man to be accused of assaulting a white woman. The police later determined, even though Roland was arrested, the charge, there's probably nothing to the accusations. And I think that they were, Dick Roland was being held in jail as much for his own protection as anything else. And that things probably would have died there were it not for kind of a race-baiting newspaper man in Tulsa by the name of Richard Lloyd Jones, who published a front-page editorial of his paper on May 31st under the headline, "To Lynch Negro Tonight." And within a few minutes, hundreds of people had gathered around the courthouse where Roland was being held. And the paper also made its way to Greenwood, the Black community, where these veterans read it, took up arms, and basically said, hell no, it's not happening here. They went down to the courthouse to offer their services to the white sheriff. And during one of these visits, late, probably about 10:30 at night on the 31st, a shot was fired and all hell broke loose. And that's where the bloodshed began. The Blacks fell back across the tracks, and they're preparing for what everyone knew was coming. And at just after 5 a.m. the following morning, there was a whistle that was a signal to this mob of about 10,000 people who had been situated strategically around the Greenwood neighborhood to begin the attack. And I think by noon of that day, the community had been pretty much obliterated.
Listen to our full interview with Tim Madigan on this Thursday's episode of The Aftermath.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Okay, so on the board for who's to blame for the Tulsa massacre, white people, racism, Birth of a Nation and director D.W. Griffith, unemployment, white entitlement, capitalism, Tulsa police, Sheriff McAuliffe, Chief of Police John Gustafson, Sarah Page, the Tulsa Tribune, the National Guard, and the rumor mill.
I mean, I feel like the National Guard, you can't blame them. They just showed up and exacerbated and like were racist.
Yeah.
They certainly didn't help.
I do think the Tulsa Tribune is very high up there for me. And the rumor mill, in a way, we can probably take the rumor mill off because it was agitated by the Tulsa Tribune.
Yeah, I agree.
I kind of think maybe Sheriff McAuliffe we could take off because I think the chief of police is worse than McAuliffe, who McAuliffe seemed a little bit more like he was not a strong leader and he was sort of chaotic. But I don't know. It's hard to really prove intent on his part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what we could do is kind of put the Sheriff McAuliffe and the chief of police with the and just call it the Tulsa Police Department. And I think the police chief, he is one of the ones who was actually the handing the guns to the white mob telling them. So should we take capitalism off?
Yeah, I think it exacerbates, but I don't think it's the cause.
It's tough because, like, you could definitely blame slavery on capitalism for slavery.
Mm. We're all just staring at this board.
I know.
I'm going to suggest we take off Birth of a Nation because obviously we'd love to put that in jail, but I don't know if we can specifically pin it on that.
For this.
It didn't start the massacre.
Yeah.
It didn't start the massacre, but it did flare up tensions. But yes. I guess in that case, we can take off unemployment.
It feels like an underlying definite circumstance, but maybe not the cause of this specifically. I think I'm trying to sort out because all of the main kind of unrest started at the courthouse. And then after the shots were fired, after the attacks started, the veterans retreated towards Greenwood. And then that's when kind of the looting, the major destruction, the rioting and the destruction of Greenwood all kind of went off. So that to me, it's like there's the initial stuff that happens at the courthouse. And then there is everybody getting handed a gun and told to go chase those guys and follow them to Greenwood that then leads to the actual worst of the destruction, I think.
I think that going off of that, too, I think what you were saying, yes, there was that initial scuffle where I believe it was 2 black men and 10 white men were killed. And after that, there was during the retreat, there was a period of this rumor being that there was a black uprising, which maybe was perpetuated by the fact that more white people were killed in that initial incident than black people. So, I mean, I know we took rumor mill off there, but there's something in there about like the snowball effect of the story that they were telling themselves to amp themselves up for the violence.
Well, that could be the Tulsa Tribune and or the Tulsa police, who obviously the right thing would have been to do to try to de-escalate the situation. But
they did not. Everything I've read has said that they were only escalating.
Sounds about right.
That was on their uniform, like a patch.
We only escalate.
Yeah,
right. To protect whites and escalate.
That hasn't changed much.
Nope. The pledge.
Is there something to say about like the white fear of the black man? Is that what like caused the panic?
I don't know. I feel like that's almost letting the white mob off the hook because it was coming from fear to me seems like a cover for it coming from greed and entitlement. Mm-hmm. Like
for sure. I mean, everything we've talked about too is about them feeling jealous of the upward mobility of these quote unquote inferior, immoral people.
Yeah. And I guess to say it's panic means that if it's on the spot, it's been brewing for, you know, hundreds of years.
Also, if you're scared, you don't go out and murder and burn someone's house down. You like hide in your own house.
That's true.
True. I mean, I do think you're onto something, though, because it like at its root, doesn't it feel like maybe that it is fear of losing what you have or fear of someone else basically supplanting you in terms of like a power structure? I mean, I don't know. It entitlement, I guess, encapsulates that too. But it does feel like they're at its root. Ultimately, it's terror that the things that you have accumulated or the status that you've established for yourself is going to go away because of these other people.
Maybe someone we could talk about that we might be able to eliminate or not is Sarah Page.
Yeah, I have such a hard time with this because I keep going back and forth where I'm like, you know, she did recant. Pure speculation now. It's as likely to me that she was coerced by police officers to maybe say that this was a little bit more aggressive than it was. It's just as likely that she got freaked out and screamed and then people responded and she didn't know what else to do. And so she just, you know, or she just was a bad person and made the shit up.
I mean, I hate to use like an internet term, but isn't she kind of a Karen?
For sure.
I could just see her being a little Tulsa Karen.
Well, here's something that it's just a little Tulsa Karen. something that I read that's helping me kind of maybe take her off the board is in, so this is from the commission to study this and from Tulsa. In the report, it says that a clerk from a clothing store located on the first floor of the building heard what he thought was a woman scream. And apparently seeing Dick Rowland flee the building, he rushed to the elevator where he found her distraught. He decided she'd been a victim of attempted sexual assault and summoned the police. So So I feel like a little bit better about she didn't go to the police and then say this happened. Mm-hmm. This other guy said, you know, heard a scream and then called the police. And so maybe, yeah. So who's this clerk? Let's put him in her
place.
The
clerk is the Karen.
Mm-hmm. Let's put the clerk up. It was definitely,
I mean, we're
a white
taking
clerk.
Things down, Rebecca. I don't normally allow things to be put up on the board at this point.
Just so people know, we've got, why don't we take National Guard and capitalism off the board? Mm-hmm. And so people know what we've got going on. It's white people, racism, white entitlement, Tulsa police, Chief Gustafson, and the Tulsa Tribune. I think like we can put Gustafson with the Tulsa police.
Here's a big question for us. Are we going for racism? Because if we want to put racism in the jail, we can do it today. But I don't know if we're feeling like we want to get more specific for Tulsa.
Right. It's like, are we blaming the underlying cause of all of the unrest, or are we blaming the very specific thing that set this event off? I guess is how do we?
I think without the underlying cause, it's hard for this to blow out of proportion. I think we can't separate the two, and that makes me feel like we should blame racism.
And white entitlement is a part of that.
White entitlement is a product of racism, or is racism a product of white entitlement?
So racism to me encapsulates all of the structural conditions, political, legal, you know, moral, everything that was the structural setup that allowed for white superiority. So it's the playing field, right? White entitlement is, I guess, one expression of that for me. The person standing there with a gun thinking, I need to go destroy this business because I'm better than those people, or I want what they have, or I want them to not have what they have. That to me is a condition. It's one of the like expressions of racism, but it isn't like to me. I mean, like when I talk about racism, I think more in terms of like the structural setup and not in terms of like just hatred and expression of hate. Right. And so I think in this instance, like racism was the foundation, like it was the world that everybody was living in. But the idea that these specific people wanted to destroy what those other people had was an expression, I think, of white entitlement.
OK, I agree with that.
I like that, too, because I think just it's so specific. What is like so insane about this is that like something that was so awesome, which was this black community thriving, was just like so triggering for these white people that they had to destroy it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. It was a threat somehow.
When it was really taking nothing away from them. And like there's something to me a little bit more has a little bit more bite to send white entitlement.
I think the three that we can leave up on the, you know, and between these, we have to figure out who the big slap is going to. But we have white entitlement, Tulsa police, and Tulsa Tribune.
Yeah. So are we all into sending white entitlement to jail? And then let's deliberate between Tulsa police and Tulsa Tribune, who we think gets the big slap.
Yes. I'm behind that.
Yeah.
I'm behind that.
I think that mm-hmm. works.
It's hard for me to let the police off the hook.
Setting aside anything that's happening right now, literally just speaking about this police department and this event, it feels like their charge and the charge of police in general is to protect the citizens, right? It's to serve as a barrier between chaos and order. And so in abandoning that and participating in that, it does feel more egregious to me than just like, you know, oh, we let this happen. Like deputizing people and handing guns out and being like, go get a Negro. It's so antithetical to what they are there to be doing that it feels like I feel like that's a little bit more blameworthy than just riling people up.
100% agree with that.
I feel like, because even if the Tribune hadn't happened, you still have police handing out guns to drunk white men who would then incite violence.
We sometimes will allow a backhand.
Let's bring it on. We need it.
Yeah, if ever there was a place to get a backhand slap, it feels like Tulsa Tribune earned it.
I'm gonna call it. Tulsa Police, you're getting the big slap. Tulsa Tribune, you got the backhand. White Entitlement, you're going to the alarmist jail. I can't believe we got through that massive.
I know, we fixed it.
We fixed it.
If we only knew it was that easy back then. Just do a podcast.
Just do a podcast.
Well, Randy, thank you so much for joining us today and helping us get to the bottom of who's doing.
It was such an honor.
After the massacre, a period of martial law immediately followed the massacre as the city attempted to rebuild. The governor demanded a full inquiry into what happened and swore that people would be held responsible. He ordered that a grand jury investigate the cause of the riot and massacre. After listening to 12 days of interview and testimony, the all-white male jury concluded, quote, "We find that the recent race riot was the direct result of an effort on the part of a certain group of black men who appeared at the courthouse on the night of May 31st, 1921, for the purpose of protecting one Dick Rowland, then and now in the custody of the sheriff of Tulsa County, for an alleged assault upon a young white woman. There was no mob spirit among the whites, no talk of lynching, and no arms. The assembly was quiet until the arrival of the armed blacks, which precipitated and was the direct cause of the entire affair." The grand jury recommended further racial segregation so that, quote, "a proper relationship may be maintained between the two races." Despite the overwhelming evidence to the contrary, no whites were ever sent to prison for the murders and arson that occurred. Very few insurance claims were paid to the black businesses and homeowners of Greenwood because most policies excluded riot damage from coverage. According to AmericanHistoryUSA.com, the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921 was rarely mentioned in history books, classrooms, or even in private. Blacks and whites alike grew into middle age unaware of what had taken place. With the number of survivors declining in 1996, the state legislature commissioned a report to establish the historical record of the events and acknowledge the victims and damages to the black community. For who you think is to blame by going to thealarmistpodcast.com. Follow us at thealarmistthe on Twitter, at thealarmistpodcast on Instagram, or email us at thealarmistpodcast@gmail.com. Tune in next week. We'll be discussing the Stonewall Riots.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.